As AI continues to revolutionize our world, there's a critical conversation we can't ignore: AI safety and security. And that's where HackerOne's AI red teaming comes into play, rigorously testing AI models to prevent them from being misled or exploited. HackerOne employs over 2 million ethical hackers, and 750 of them specialize in prompt hacking and other AI security and testing. So HackerOne isn't just theorizing, they're actively safeguarding AI's future. Just recently, a team unearthed over 100 vulnerabilities in just 2 weeks. So whether you're at the helm of a startup or steering product innovation at a large company, it's time to prioritize AI security. Visit HackerOne.com/AI for more. Again, HackerOne.com/AI.
This episode is sponsored by porkbun.com. Porkbun is a refreshingly different domain name registrar that's different from the other ones like GoDaddy or Namecheap. They've got low prices on hundreds of different domain extensions. They've got everything from .com domains to really cool ones like .pro, .dev, .xyz. Every domain name at Porkbun comes with tons of freebies too, like SSL certificate, whois privacy, DNS, URL forwarding, and hosting trials. Because why pay for things that should be free, right? All these incredible features and tools are backed by incredible support, 365 days a year, and more 5-star reviews on Trustpilot from real customers than anyone else. Look, you can get $1 off your next domain name from Porkbun and see why they're the best domain name registrar around by using our code. Just go to porkbun.com/rocketshipfm24. That's porkbun, porkbun.com/rocketshipfm24. You'll save $1 on your next domain. This episode is brought to you by Gigantic. At Gigantic, you can level up your product skills through live, small group, cohort-based trainings. We're incredibly excited to welcome you to our next cohort of our product strategy training, kicking off in January of 2024. This course will take you through the frameworks that product leaders use at companies like eBay, DoorDash, Groupon, Rent the Runway, in order to scale their teams. It's taught by Ben Foster, a friend of this podcast, who is the former chief product officer at Whoop. So come join us. Go to gigantic.is. That's gigantic.is. And save your seat for our January cohort. Your potential is gigantic, and we're here to help you reach it. Go to gigantic.is to reserve your seat today.
Welcome to the Rocket Ship Podcast. I'm Michael Sacca.
I'm Joelle Steiniger.
And I'm Matt Goldman.
And we're having 20-minute talks with entrepreneurs teaching you how to launch your product into revenue.
Check out our book at howtobuildarocketship.com to reserve your launch discount and to download a free chapter. Today we talked with Nick Francis, co-founder and CEO of Help Scout. We've been trying so hard lately to get the perspective of someone who's found the sacred middle ground between raising venture capital and bootstrapping. Nick talks about the early days of Help Scout, moving from a consultancy to being fully focused on their product. He also covers the impact that Techstars Boston had on Help Scout's trajectory. Get ready for some amazing insights into the funding process and how to build a product that customers love without making any sacrifices.
Welcome to the Rocket Ship Podcast. We're here with Nick Francis, the co-founder and CEO of Help Scout. Nick, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So tell us a little bit about how you guys found the idea of Help Scout.
Sure. So for those that don't know, Help Scout is a help desk tool that's optimized for a great customer experience. And the way that we kind of came up with the idea was my two co-founders and I have been working together 9+ years, and we had built a couple of web apps together, and essentially it was just searching for a help desk ourselves. Customer service is always something I've been super passionate about, and customer experience in particular, and just felt like none of the existing tools at the time were able to kind of mimic the customer experience that we wanted to give to customers. It felt a little bit too robotic and a little bit impersonal, and we felt like there was a really great opportunity there. And so that's kind of where the idea started.
And so when you started, you were running an agency and building Help Scout at the same time. What was that like?
Yeah, so we had a client consultancy that we did for 5+ years, where really my co-founders and I were just learning how to build things for the web. We worked for small businesses. We worked for really large companies doing UX consulting. It was kind of every kind of business that existed on the web. At one point or another, we had helped them out with something. And so we were just trying to get good at our craft. You know, that's what the consulting business was about. But we always wanted to build web apps. That was always the dream. And so we had tried our hand at a couple of things. But for some reason, Help Scout really struck a chord. We said, you know what, we could really build a big business with this. So let's kind of go all in. I remember the day just kind of sitting at our office, and I had some Sharpie mock-ups, and I just said, guys, I know we've been doing this for 5+ years and it's cool and it's fine or whatever, but the dream's always been to build web apps. Here on this piece of paper with Sharpie drawings on it is our future. Are you in or are you out? They were in, thankfully.
So what were some of the challenges that you faced trying to balance the two?
Oh, it was super hard. I think, and we had been doing client work so long. I mean, because you admire companies like, of course, 37 Signals at the time, and Litmus was a company that we really looked up to, Campaign Monitor. All these companies were born through a consultancy where they just kind of worked on the web app in their spare time. And I think those guys were just much more talented and had much more disposable income than we did. We couldn't make it work, to be honest. We needed to be 100% in. And so essentially what we did was save up our money as much as we could so that we could work on Help Scout for like 3 straight months.
Okay.
And then see where we ended up.
And so what was kind of the conclusion of that? What'd you guys come to?
The conclusion was we ended up applying for Techstars here in Boston. We're originally from Tennessee. And so thankfully we got in, and that bought us another 20K, which is another 3 months to work on the product. And we were able to launch V1 during that process.
What did you learn in Techstars?
A more appropriate question would be, what did I not learn?
Okay, what didn't you learn?
we learned a lot about everything from customer acquisition to just kind of the basics of what it takes to build a SaaS business. You know, we came in 3 product guys, so we knew the technical side of things and we knew how to make a product. But one thing that entrepreneurs don't really know going in is that very little of the business is actually about the product. Acquiring the customer is actually much more important, at least early on. So we learned a ton about that. And in addition to that, you know, just kind of fundraising and that aspect of things as well. So we learned a tremendous amount. I'm not sure Help Scout would be around if it wasn't for the program. So we're tremendously grateful.
Yeah, that's awesome. And you guys have kind of a middle of the road approach to funding. You're not just going all in raising $100 million. Tell us a little bit about how you came to that conclusion that this is the way that you guys wanted to build a business.
Well, when you think about the companies that we've always looked up to and loved, all of our favorite products have kind of shared one thing in common, which is more of a bootstrapped mentality, really focused on a great customer experience and building a great product that's without compromises. And I think one thing that you find as you kind of look through the fundraising landscape and what it takes to build a really big business or go public or whatever aspirations you may have is that it requires you to make compromises. So in terms of growth, if you want to grow really fast, I think that you're going to have to make some compromises in terms of product and customer experience that we just weren't willing to make. And so we found the right group of people that were able to give us some seed funding. I was very honest about the fact that we didn't want to take venture capital. And those guys really supported us, and gals. And you know, that's kind of how things started in terms of fundraising. But that was our mentality.
So how long did it take you guys to become profitable?
It took us about 2.5 years to become profitable. We raised about $800,000 from about 20 angel investors, all just individuals, no entities, which is what made it easier to say we're not raising a Series A or anything. That was all the values or all the motivations were aligned. You know, everybody wins in that scenario when you're dealing with angels. And so, we got profitable within, you know, we wanted to make it so that we could stretch that dollar as far as we could. And so we were aggressively spending. We tried to build the team and really grow the business as much as we could without running out of money. And so it took 2.5 years. If we really had to, we could have gotten profitable earlier. But that was kind of the right thing for us.
Hey, guys. I hope you're enjoying the episode. I wanted to take a minute to thank CodeShip for sponsoring the show. CodeShip makes continuous deployment simple and easy. And we've actually been happy customers of theirs for a very long time. You should go to codeship.io/rocketship to check out videos and tutorials all about how you can start using CodeShip to deploy your product in a better way. Enjoy the rest of the episode. So what are the scenarios in which this pays off for the angels that you have?
So there's lots of scenarios. I mean, when a business has cash, there's lots of options at our disposal in terms of liquidity and getting our angels a win. I think the more important question for them when they were writing the check is this business going to be a successful one? And I think thus far we've been able to prove that we can build a really big business. And they're not tremendously worried. These are wealthy individuals anyways, so they're not dying to get their 25 or 50K or whatever back. They're just rooting for us. You know, they're rooting for us to go build a $100 million, $200 million business and see what's next after that. So I think that liquidity is a pretty easy thing if you've got cash in a successful business. The hard part is actually building a successful business.
When Rainn Wilson realized he had a special gift for talking people to sleep, he had two choices: construct a massive speaker that would blast his voice to every person in the country, or invent a talking pillow. AT&T Business eventually talked him into the pillow thing. And backed by a reliable network, the only network with built-in security controls, Sleep with Rainn was a hit. Take your ideas to the moon and beyond at business.att.com. That's business.att.com.
Could you go into a little bit more detail on what the exits are for the angels that you have? Is it selling their shares to someone else at a higher rate? Are there other options besides that?
Yeah, you know, there's a few ways. You know, one would just be through acquisition, right? If a company buys Help Scout, which I have to entertain. You know, we're probably not going to go public. So one would include just the company buying back shares. So for instance, if we've got $10 million in the bank in a few years, which is not out of the question, then we could say, hey, we want to buy back, you know, 10% of the company and liquidate shareholders at this return. So we'll give you a 20x return. We'll buy back your shares. And that way you get liquidity. Another way of doing things is through there's private equity and there's what they call growth venture capital, which is, you know, like you guys probably saw GitHub do this. They raised $100 million when they were very profitable as a business on their own. Uh-huh. Well, a lot of that was to, and same thing with Atlassian recently. They raised a ton of money on a $3.3 billion valuation. And really, they were very upfront about it. I loved how upfront about it they were. They're like, well, we're not going to go public, so we need to liquidate some of our early shareholders, and raising this $200 million or whatever they raised was a great way to do that. You know, when you got a successful business, there are a number of parties that would be willing to throw money at you in terms of just putting it somewhere where it can grow, because there's a lot of finance geeks that are looking for places to park money. Mm-hmm. And so there are innumerable opportunities. I mean, you guys probably just saw Campaign Monitor took $250 million. They've never taken a dime of capital, right? But they still have shareholders. And maybe some of those guys just wanted some liquidity of their own. And that's perfectly reasonable. And so they did a $250 million deal. It's probably not going to change the business very much in terms of the business dynamics, but they're able to liquidate some people and give them some personal wealth, which they've earned. that make sense?
Yeah. And then in terms of determining what percent to give, did you guys already have enough revenue to where you could evaluate based on that, or was there another factor?
There's basically there's a legal way of doing it. I think it's called a 409A, but we raised money at a $2.5 million pre-money valuation. Uh-huh. So we ended up at like three almost. And so if I say, let's just say it was $3 million post-money. So if I say I want to get a 10x return, then the company needs to be worth $30 million, right?
Yeah.
In order, on paper, valuation-wise, a lawyer has to look at me and say, yeah, we think Help Scout's worth $30 million. And then we would actually buy back those shares at 10x. So we'd pay, for every dollar they put in, we'd give them $10.
Got it.
And so that's kind of how it would work. And it's all based on valuations. You can get an official valuation. I think it is a 409A, but usually that's just it's a negotiation point. So what's the value of the company? You kind of throw your finger up in the air and you kind of land somewhere. I mean, that's basically what public markets are when a company like Zendesk goes public next week. Mm-hmm. They're just saying, this is what we think the company is worth right now, based on everything that we know. So that's basically how it goes. And then you can buy shares, or somebody can buy shares at that current value or whatever.
All right. So what did you guys do in the early stage to grow, or maybe even what did the funding allow you to do that maybe you couldn't do while bootstrapping?
Most importantly, it allowed us to work on the business full time, which was a dream come true, to be honest with you, and kind of accelerate a couple of things. So be able to bring on a couple of people that we just wouldn't have been able to bring on full time to kind of help us with the business. So a great example is Gregory Sciotti, the guy that you guys have had on this podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
He's an A-plus player, a really great writer, and just completely aligned with myself and my co-founders and the business in every way. A guy like that, that relationship just wouldn't have worked out if we couldn't have afforded to bring him on full time and kind of own the content marketing strategy, which is the key to our acquisition, our customer acquisition. So, as you know, the help desk space, there's several of them in the space. We're not the only ones. And I think that content marketing was key for us to kind of differentiate ourselves. And so not being able to hire a guy like Greg, not being able to hire a gal like Ivana, who runs all of our marketing, because that just wasn't where our expertise was, mm-hmm. would have made the business so much harder going forth, because it wasn't.
I think those are amazing points. And I think of what a lot of times when I think of funding, it's like, how do we spend money? On marketing, but it sounds like you invested in people, which is a great strategy.
If you read too much, like TechCrunch or Sasser or whatever your flavor of SaaS may be, then you get convinced that the only way to build a big SaaS business is through lots of funding and losing double digit millions and hiring a big sales staff to pester a bunch of people to use your product. And I frankly just don't believe that's true. There's unbelievable businesses, billion-dollar businesses, Atlassian, for example, MailChimp, for example, 37 Signals. All those, I think, are borderline billion and above businesses. And then there's companies like Wistia and Campaign Monitor. I could name off so many businesses that haven't made those compromises, yet they've still built huge businesses. And have great products. That's the one thing that they all have in common, is really great products. So I refuse to believe that you've got to lose double-digit millions to build a big business.
Yeah.
That's so refreshing to hear, because we've had so many conversations with people kind of on both sides of the aisle. And it's rare that we find someone like you who really sees that middle ground and has proven that it can work. So it's really refreshing for us.
Well, the other guys are a lot louder than we are for some reason, but that doesn't mean it's not possible. It's just you got to be a little bit more patient. And I think you do have to be focused on something more than revenues. It's not about money in our business. It really, truly is about building a product people love and that people resonate with. That's what gets me up in the morning. So sometimes it just comes down to different motivations.
So I noticed on your about page, everyone is a customer champion.
Yeah, that actually serves two purposes. The first purpose is the fact that we all are squarely focused on the customer, and I don't think any of us want to forget that.
Mm-hmm.
But the second purpose is kind of a funny purpose, but we don't want to give away any titles so that and make it easier on recruiters to pester our developers. So.
Oh, interesting.
No, I'm just joking. I don't want anybody to know I'm CEO either. I just want everybody to know that we're there for them. You know.
So do you guys have an internal hierarchy that you run, or is it kind of a flat structure?
As flat as possible.
Okay.
You know, I try to have as little decision-making power as possible. And, you know, we're only 12 people today, and we'll be 18 by the end of the year, but that's still very small. And I think we can kind of wing it for maybe another 8 people before we really have to think about what kind of structure we want.
Sure. So what kind of things are on the horizon for you guys? Are you working on any big new features?
It's really interesting. So we're going through a couple of just kind of growing pains as you know, so the whole Techstars experience is great, but you're forced to move as fast as possible. And that means sometimes you're not really building products to scale. You're just building products to work.
Okay.
And so, for instance, one of the first things we ever built was reports, which is critically important to any help desk. It's really a great feature. We felt like we needed that very early on, which we did. But the way that we built it, now that we've got lots and lots of customers, thousands of them, it doesn't scale. All this data, the way that we kind of structured it, doesn't scale. So completely re-architecting that from the ground up and building a great experience there still gets my juices flowing. We still get to build great product, but it's not overly complex product. We're just replacing existing stuff. So that's super exciting, and we still get to keep the product at its core very simple for customers. So there's that. I mean, I'm super juiced by just growing a team and figuring out what that's like. And then there's just lots of really fun marketing challenges and things that we want to invest in terms of just adding benefit to the community at large, and also trying to build a brand and figuring out how big it can be. I mean, I'm an entrepreneur that may not be interested in gobs of funding, but I'm super competitive and I want to build a huge business. So there's a lot of really fun challenges on the horizon in order for us to get there.
That's very cool. So for some of us that haven't been through Techstars, what was the biggest takeaway or lesson that you learned from that experience?
Man, I learned a lot. Well, the one I did learn a ton about just financing in general and just economics of a SaaS business or any business, the way that an investor looks at a business. And I don't know. I'm trying to pinpoint one specific thing. I think we just realized how hard it's going to be. We came in thinking, you know, I felt like we were pretty strong product people. And we felt like, you know, if we build a great product, it's going to work out for us. And the whole customer acquisition game, especially when you're in a crowded market like we are, you can't just out-execute. You really have to get the attention. You have to become part of the conversation, right? So our plan was, well, okay, we're just going to go into the help desk market with a different approach and out-execute in a certain way. That's great, but if we're not part of the conversation at large to begin with about what help desk to select, then it doesn't really matter what our product does. So understanding what it's going to take for us to acquire customers was really important. And that forced us kind of to go all in on content marketing. That's where we discovered the opportunity. So I think our takeaway from Techstars was, wow, we can really do something special in terms of content marketing because we have the patience that nobody else has in this market to do it the right way. And thus why Gregory's been such a big part of the business. And so really understanding the acquisition strategy and how all of that can work to kind of align with our product goals, I think that's what we walked away with.
So within your Techstars class, was there pressure after the 3 months to raise more? I think you guys did raise a couple more rounds, but was it...
We raised twice basically from the same group of people. So it was okay. 400K once and then 400K again from the same folks. It's interesting because Techstars certainly puts no pressure on anybody to raise any money. David Cohen, is amazing in every way. I have nothing but great things to say about him. And Katie Ray, the one that ran the Boston class, also same thing. We never got any pressure. I think the only pressure is the competitive pressure with all the other co-founders that I love, by the way. They're like brothers and sisters to me, but we're tremendously competitive. My class of Techstars has raised more money than any other Techstars class in any city. And so wow. There's some great companies in there too. So it was interesting in that sense, but we're already competing. And I think the winner, we've decided the winner has to be whoever returns the most money to Techstars. And so by not raising a lot of money, then I'm actually, I might be winning. I'm not going to speculate. But I argue with my fellow CEOs a lot. I was at dinner with one of them last week, just talking about like, who do we think is winning? Because we're all very competitive. So we have a lot of fun about it. It's not serious.
And of the angels that you had, did any of those come through connections from Techstars?
Pretty much all of them. Yeah. Yes. I mean, one of them did not, but everybody kind of came through the Techstars process and just people we met along the way. I mean, and that's why we moved from Nashville to Boston. It's important to be in a community that does a lot of angel investing and kind of has that capital and risk threshold and understanding of SaaS businesses to write checks. And that's kind of the difference from Nashville to Boston that we saw, is that there's just a community of people that really enjoy investing in companies like these and kind of having some skin in the game.
Yeah. And with your first round, did you find that you struggled to get buy-in, or you had to get a few people on board before getting real numbers?
So the key to getting some, the key is to find one person to kind of champion things on your behalf. And I was really lucky to have met and really hit it off with a guy named David Cancel. He's now the head of product at HubSpot, but he started a company called Performable. He co-founded Compete.com. For my money, he's the best product guy in the business. He's really great. And David and I just kind of instantly hit it off, and he really loved the business. And so from that, you know, David has a lot of respect in Boston. He was able to make a few phone calls, and I had like 10 people on board, including HubSpot's co-founder, Dharmesh Shah. And his name carries a lot of weight too. And so it's just kind of a domino effect. Once you get a couple of people that really believe in what you're doing, it's not too hard. It's not too difficult to find the right people that are willing to write a small check, you know. And to be clear, a $50,000 check is pretty small for a lot of angel investors, not for me personally.
Yeah.
Well, very cool. Thank you so much for coming on, Nick, and sharing your story with us.
My pleasure, guys. It's been a lot of fun.
So tell us where anyone listening can keep up with you and can find Help Scout. Where do they find you on the web?
So helpscout.net or .com goes to our website. And we've got a great blog that talks all about customer acquisition and customer loyalty. And lots of fun things coming there. We really try to invest in some great resources for fellow entrepreneurs.
It is. It's one of the best blogs out there.
Oh, thank you very much. And I'm just at Nick Francis on Twitter. If any of you guys have questions, I'd love to help in any way I can.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Rocket Ship Podcast. If you haven't yet, pop open iTunes and subscribe to be notified of future episodes. We have some really great ones lined up.
And while you're there, leave us a review. We really appreciate each and every one of them.